This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up still in Main Street, we talk about different ways to celebrate Independent Bookstore Day, which is coming up this Saturday. And of course, what better way to celebrate bookstores than by reading? And here is a novel that is setting fire to the literary world right now. It is called Firekeeper's Daughter. And the author, Angeline Booley, is someone who wanted to create a native Nancy Drew. And she does so in the character Donis Firekeeper, a determined teen who reluctantly joins forces with the FBI to investigate a pervasive meth ring on reservations and in hockey towns. Angeline Booley is an enrolled member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. She is a former director of Indian education at the U.S. Department of Education. Firekeeper's Daughter is her first novel. Angeline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I can't imagine already what it's like to put a book out into this world. But then you add on to it, you're putting a book out into this world that NPR calls an absolute powerhouse of a novel that makes the Reese Witherspoon YA Young Adults Book Club pick, that the Higher Ground production company started by the Obamas have picked up and optioned into a Netflix series when it comes to a first book. So first of all, just pause for a second. When did it feel real that you put this out there?
It is so surreal that I think I actually had to see it in a bookstore to really believe it. Even when they sent the box, a box to me of the finished book, and it was my first time holding it in my hands, that was pretty special. And my parents were at my house, so they got to see it. But really, I think it took seeing it in a book on a bookshelf that, yeah.
As I understand, the germ of this book planted itself, the seed of this book planted itself in your head when you were a teenager. It sat there for a couple decades, and then you spent another decade or so writing it.
Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Well, let's go back to that teenage self and then the teenage protagonist that's in this book, Donis. And I'm wondering, how did you put yourself in that mindset of still remembering what it's like to be a woman in this coming of age, tender part of life?
I felt things so strongly that I think I just was scarred, for lack of a better word, by all the things that, you know, happened when I was younger, and the things that really made an impression on me. And then seeing, you know, I have three kids, and my boys were teenagers when I started writing. My daughter was a preteen, and she's now a senior in college. And then I've always worked in Indian education. So I've always been around teens, and just seeing the similar things that my students have gone through and my children, I think that's why I felt so connected still to things that happened to me when I was much younger.
It's so important in the book that your people, the Anishinaabe, and particularly the women, are called upon to solve their own problems. There's a hilarious line in the book where you say that one of the worst things that white people can do is say, "Hey, I'm here from the federal government and I'm here to help," or just, you know, "I'm here to help," and just have no concept of the loaded language that comes into a phrase like "I'm here to help." So just that thread of wanting young women in particular to have that sense of agency? Why was that so important to you?
Because young people do have so much agency. And, you know, and she's so close to her Aunt Teddy. And so, you know, she's been raised with Teddy's comments, you know, and observations about things, how things work. And these are not secrets in the Native community. The FBI has a, and the, you know, other federal agencies don't have a good reputation with right. tribes for the most part.
The title, Firekeeper's Daughter. I want to start with Firekeeper. It's both a last name, but really a calling. What does it mean among the Anishinaabe people to be a firekeeper?
Well, firekeepers are men who have been taught how to strike ceremonial fires, and they're tasked with maintaining that fire for the duration of the event, whether it's a funeral or a fasting camp. And they also maintain the protocols because those are special fires, and you know, you don't gossip or drink or, you know, speak badly about someone. You only talk about good things, sharing stories. That fire is serving a purpose for what it's doing. So, and my father is a firekeeper. So I've spent many times, you know, with him on the fire and just listening to all these stories that, you know, he might not, he never, things that he didn't teach me when I was younger, but now when he's sitting at the fire, he just is so full of all of these stories. And firekeeper, it was multiple layers of why I, you know, picked that. So there's that, you know, that role in the community. And then also one of our teachings about firekeeper's daughter, she's the daughter of the first firekeeper, and she starts each day by lifting the sun with a song. And so that really was to, I really liked that teaching and the way that Donis would react to it, because it's all about what is your duty and what is your role in your community. And that's something that, you know, Donis goes through moments where she doesn't want this responsibility. She doesn't want to be in the position that she's in of, you know, helping the FBI with this investigation. And so that was another powerful way to have the story be aligned with our cultural teachings.
With a title like Firekeeper's Daughter, there's an exploration here of what it means to be named after sort of a male line before you start to come in to your own.
Yeah, and you know, her identity as an Ojibwe young woman, she thinks of herself in all these different roles, you know, the daughter of, the niece of,
right.
And then she's, you know, adds that extra name to her prayer every morning when she introduces herself to be sure that Creator knows who she is. And at some point she recognizes that she's the one who wasn't sure about things, that Creator's always known who she is.
But there is that importance, that stepping into the part of it that is writing your own story, even if Creator already knew where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
How important were rituals to you growing up?
I think I took them for granted because my dad is Ojibwe, and he would do things a certain way, and we just thought that, for example, we just thought everyone puts loose tobacco in a casket when a loved one, you know, at a loved one's funeral. And then finding out, oh, that's putting tobacco in for their journey, and this is what we do. And so I think I grew up with different teachings that were never explained, but they were just part of how we lived. And then as an adult or later, just finding out what the cultural, the teachings behind that.
One thing that you had to teach yourself, this would not at all be a cultural tradition or a ritual or something that a person should learn how to do. You learned how to make meth to write this book.
Yes, I did.
Wow.
I learned by from the state police. That's not the normal book research that gets done.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I mean, how did you even present this? Because this was something that law enforcement was going to do, and they need to learn how so that they can identify if there's meth happening in their community. But I'm just wondering the reaction of, oh, I'm writing a book about meth. Can I learn this?
I was on some committee in Sault Ste. Marie, and there was a professor there from the university, and he's a former law enforcement officer. And so he had really good connections at the State Police Academy. And we had talked about my book. He was really interested in it. And then he said, if you're willing, I think that I could set something up where you could attend one of these classes. It was incredible just learning the different methods of making meth and then how to spot clandestine meth labs, which, you know, meth is especially prevalent in rural areas. So that's the Upper Peninsula. And just finding out all the different places that law enforcement has found meth lab operations going on. Yeah, it's pretty startling.
Throughout the book, there is this concept of the difference between good medicine and bad medicine. Meth very much, of course, falls into this category of bad medicine. What do you mean when you say good medicine versus bad medicine?
Good medicine is for healing, and bad medicine is the opposite side of that coin. Mm-hmm. You know, we learn that medicines are serious business and you don't mess around with things that you don't know all about. I needed to be really careful about how I talked about bad medicine because mm-hmm. that is a real thing in my community. You know, there's a lot of things that aren't meant for outside of the community.
Mm. Am I correct in also reading that there is an intention and a purpose behind something that might sometimes be a good medicine, but if the intention is wrong, it can be a bad medicine?
Yeah, I think that is possible, that the intention of how you are going to use that medicine can transform, you know, and those are just teachings that I have gotten about, you know, about our plants and our medicines. So,
yeah. Well, in the book, Donis, still a teenager, is very well versed in plant medicine of the Anishinaabe people near the Great Lakes area of this land. At that age, when you were that age, were you aware of these medicines, or is this something you had to learn as an adult?
No, I wasn't very familiar with them, but my grandma would. Again, like my dad, my grandma would just do certain things. And I guess mm-hmm. I just thought that everybody's grandma maybe boiled rags with some different plants mm-hmm. and wrap it around your neck to keep so that you wouldn't catch cold. But it was so stinky that people stayed away from you. So maybe you weren't catching cold because you weren't in there. Yeah. You know, I think that when you just grow up seeing things done and it's normal to you mm-hmm. that it's just a part of your life, and then maybe when you're older you realize, oh, I was learning about some very old medicines by my grandmother and I didn't realize it at the time.
So how are you teaching these to your own offspring and to the next generation?
Well, I own the family land on Sugar Island mm-hmm. and there's that connection with the land, and then really it's seeing what my kids are interested in and
which of my cousins or nieces or family members are interested in learning more about it. And, those are the ones that I'll spend more time telling stories or talking about things.
We're visiting today with Angeline Bouley. She is the author of Fire Keeper's Daughter. This is her first novel. And Angeline, let's talk a little bit more about the actual structure of the book. We talked about how you had this first idea when you were a teenager, and you grew up reading and loving a character like Nancy Drew, but Nancy Drew, aside from being a girl, wasn't looking like you, didn't have the same cultural references and backgrounds that you might have. So, just why or where did the idea come from that you were going to give such a young woman so much power and responsibility?
Well, I learned about the hero's journey when my kids were younger. And I'm not sure where it exactly started, but my kids and I were talking about the similarities between Star Wars and Harry Potter. And so I heard about something called the hero's journey. So I did a little bit of research, and then I thought it would be kind of a fun activity for one of my sons and my daughter to talk about, plot out like what were similar, what things were similar. And then I started doing more reading about the hero's journey. And I thought, well, we have our heroes, or we have our hero stories, and different ways that cultural teachings are passed down through story. And then I thought, what if it was a hero's journey, but told from an Ojibwe young woman's perspective? What if she was the hero in a story? Also, I saw a, I'm a visual person, and so I saw this circle that had the hero's journey plotted out, kind of like numbers on a clock. So you'd have like, this is when this happens, and then this, and this, and this. And I happened to see it, and then right after that, I saw the visual depiction of the Ojibwe medicine wheel, and that is split into four sections, and it covers like the four directions, four colors, the four different teachings that we get through that medicine wheel. And I thought, wait, what if the hero's journey and the medicine wheel teachings, what if I overlaid that and her journey followed that medicine, those medicine wheel teachings? And that felt like a eureka moment. And that's, yeah, that was when I really thought, okay, there's something to this, of telling this story in this indigenous way.
Yeah, the book is in four main sections. There's the journey to the east, the south, the west, the north, dividing the story into those four cardinal directions. What is the significance of that?
Well, putting it in cultural terms and book terms, a lot of books are done in a three-act structure, but with the medicine wheel and our teachings, then four is a very strong number. Part one, the eastern direction, it's a time of new beginnings. And so that was really laying out the world building for the reader to be immersed in Daunus's experience. And then, it takes you through the inciting incident and her choosing to be part of the investigation. And so that's like stepping from the known world into the unknown. And then that southern direction is really a time for wandering and wondering. And so that's where her identity as a confidential informant, or as she calls it, a secret squirrel. And all of these fun and games of her learning things and either failing or succeeding at different tasks that she's trying to do. And then the western direction, the stakes really get much, are much higher, coming to a climax, and that finding out the truth of what is going on. And then, of course, that northern direction symbolizes that wisdom when we're in that part of our journey. To know truth is to know that there's so many things that are that can't be known, and that acceptance of it. And so that really felt right for the course of the story.
Yeah, she's so wise in that journey in the north. I mean, she's clever and she's smart throughout the whole book, but by the time she gets to her journey in the north, she really has become wise and still so young. And I'm thinking in particular, and I don't want to give away any major plot points, but of course this is a YA novel. There is a little bit of a love interest. We got to keep the teenagers interested on multiple levels here. And then you work into how a young woman can approach a relationship and be with somebody, but first she has to be her own person.
Yes. I think, you know, it's so important for women to have healthy boundaries and to love themselves. And so I think that, you know, we hope that, I think the earlier you learn that, the better off you are, because there are some really painful lessons. If you don't learn that, it keeps getting repeated over and over in terms of unhealthy dating or relationship patterns. To see Donis get that and understand it and put that into practice, I felt that was such a good thing to show. That you can love someone and make choices that honor both of you.
It's one of the most difficult parts of parenting, in my opinion, is watching your children make mistakes and you're just sitting there screaming, but I've already made this mistake. I can save you from this pain. Do you feel that way as, you know, the parent, if you will, of the characters that you're creating, making some horrendous mistakes?
Oh, I do. And, you know, I worked on the book for 10 years. So I have draft versions where Donis is perfect and makes every right decision and frankly was a boring character. And I have other ones where, you know, it just the story has evolved so much. But I remember one time I was trying to write a draft where Donis does not like Jamie and continues to not like him throughout the story. And it just, those two crazy kids just kept fighting their way back to each other. It was like, I tried to make them steer right, but they kept going left. And I remember commenting to someone, I was like, they're making such poor decisions. I just can't even handle it. And the person was a writer also. And they said, those are my best kind of characters.
I never get tired of hearing an author basically say that they're not the ones in control of what the characters are doing.
I think, you know, when you know your characters so well and you trust that maybe the story is bigger than you, that when I'm writing a scene and I think the scene is going to go in one direction and then some idea just takes hold and I just get out of my way and I just type whatever is coming to me because I feel there's so much value in that, that like you're honoring that wherever these ideas are coming from, I will just type away. Just keep them coming.
You have expressed sometimes you're frustrated at their decisions. Are you ever surprised by what your characters are doing?
Yeah. Because over the 10 years and the various drafts, there have been various villains. I would say that there's probably a draft out there with each character in the book a villain at one point. And so it just, there was one character that I was convinced was a villain. And then he revealed to me that he wasn't. And so that was really interesting because that was probably one of the last major changes I made in my last draft. And
Wow.
to me, it added such a layer to the story. I'm just so happy about it.
That's author Angeline Bouley talking about her new book, Fire Keeper's Daughter. Still to come on Main Street, we talk about what's next for this book, including that you'll soon be able to watch it on Netflix. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state of North Dakota is teaming up with officials from Manitoba to get the COVID-19 vaccine to essential workers who bring goods and services across the international border. Manitoba Premier Brian Pallister was joined by Governor Doug Burgum in making the announcement.
It is estimated that as many as 4,000 Manitoba drivers will be taking part in this program. And I am confident that this initiative will be successful, and we do hope to expand this program to meet other vaccination needs for Manitobans in the future as well.
Governor Burgum says the agreement between the two governments is an historic event considering the challenging times. Burgum says the idea was brought up by Premier Pallister as the U.S. looks at an abundance of vaccine while Canada is seeing reduced levels. Burgum says the program begins Wednesday with a pilot site at the I-29 Alexander Hendry Visitor Site near Drayton.
So again, trying to pick a location and a time frame that's convenient. The hours, I think, are going to run from noon till 8 p.m. each day. We'll have nurses and EMT staff that are there to safely administer either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. And then we'll have EMTs and others there to do the 15-minute monitoring to make sure that no one's having an allergic reaction. So all standard safety protocols will be in place. And I think it's going to be, again, super convenient meeting people where they are and getting the job done for our essential workers.
Burgum says getting the essential workers vaccinated is important when you consider 365,000 trucks crossed into North Dakota last year alone. Former Vice President Walter Mondale has died at age 93. Mondale is a former U.S. Senator from Minnesota. He also served as Minnesota's Attorney General. He was Jimmy Carter's vice president. Vice presidential historian Tim Walsh says Mondale redefined the nation's number two office.
I think the relationship between President Carter and Vice President Mondale was as solid as any president-vice presidential relationship that I'm aware of in history. Both had the right spirit of collaboration, and both had mutual respect for one another's skills.
In 1984, Mondale lost 49 states to President Ronald Reagan. He also ran for the U.S. Senate again after Paul Wellstone was killed in a plane crash 11 days before the 2002 election. Republican Norm Coleman won that race. And as a gift to the city, the Fargo Lions Club has announced a plan to design, build, and install a new piece of public art meant to remember and commemorate those who used sandbags to save Fargo in the 1997 Red River flood. Lions Club member Bruce Furness was mayor during that flood when 25,000 volunteers worked frantically to help fill and build miles of dikes.
We would have lost that flood had we not had all these people, which we call sandbaggers. And we won the fight with the sandbaggers who came from all these different places. And what you see there is going to be a piece of art recognizing all of those people who worked frantically to fill the sandbags. And they, along with the thousands of other people, saved the city.
Named the Spirit of the Sandbagger, the gateway arch with metal images of the workers on top will be mounted on pillars already erected in Riverside Gardens, near the Red River, east of City Hall. A number of businesses and groups have already donated to the project, and the public is also being asked to contribute to a fund set up by the FM Area Foundation. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra's 95th season finale will take place on Saturday, April 24th at 7:30 p.m. in Ann Nicole Nelson Hall at Minot State University. The grand finale will feature works by Grieg, Bartok, and Mozart. Tickets for the in-person performance or the live stream are available now at MinotSymphony.com or by phone at 701-858-4228. The Minot Symphony Grand Finale, April 24th.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are continuing our conversation today with author Angeline Bouley behind the book Fire Keeper's Daughter, telling the story of teenager Donna's Firekeeper, who joins forces with the FBI to investigate a meth ring impacting her community. What's your process for working with an editor? I'm always wondering, is it, okay, I've done all I can do, it's your turn, or are you apprehensive just saying, like, I put myself onto these pages, please be gentle?
So I was fortunate that there were a number of editors that were interested in their publishing house getting the rights to the book. And so I had conversations with every editor that was interested. And that helped me to see like what their vision was and what my vision was for the story. For example, if a publisher didn't feel that my story would be a lead title for the season that they were thinking of, that didn't interest me. And so really it was the publisher, the editor that was most in sync with where I saw my book going and could bring something to that process that I couldn't achieve without their help. And so it was respecting that. And that's what my editor did. So in that first phone call that I ever had with her, she spoke so quickly. And she told me, you know, you're introducing too many secondary characters in your first act, and all of these secondary characters are going to be so much more memorable as suspects. And that was such a light bulb moment of, oh my God, she just figured out why I am struggling so hard with act one. And so it was, you know, very much looking forward to that type of input. And, you know, there were things that maybe she would say, would you consider this? And I would say, oh, absolutely not. And then we would go back and forth and talking about it. And then I would kind of simmer and think about it. And then I would realize she's right, but I'm right too. But how can I accomplish what I wanted to do with this scene, but still take into account the very valid points that she's bringing up? And that made the story so much stronger because I really had to think through, why is this incident in the book? And how could I be more responsible about it? Is there a different place in the story where this could happen, where it would have more impact than if it's clustered in with the climax and all these other things, and it doesn't give the reader a chance to breathe? And so that's a really great example of how working with the right editor, it just becomes this really engaging dialogue where you explore different ways of telling the story and what your purpose, what your intent is, and how their expertise can help you take that story somewhere even better than what you could have imagined.
There is so much pain in this book. There's meth addiction, there's rape, there is severe racism, but it's almost like that becomes just the surface level. That's the tip of the iceberg in this book. Even deeper, at least to my reading, is the strength and the love and the cultural ties within this book. Was that a conscious choice on your part, or is it just a natural consequence of the deep love and connection that you have to your culture?
It's both. You know, one of the mantras I had was, I'm writing about trauma, but I'm not writing a tragedy. And so I wasn't writing, I've heard some authors say trauma porn or mining your community's trauma. And so I really wanted to balance that with all the wonderful things about my community. And yes, there are some awful things that have happened. And we also have some wonderful healing ways that also have been passed down through generations. And so if you only hear about the trauma, you're not getting the full story about my community or my family.
I'm not entirely sure how to ask this next question, but so I'm thinking of this example of one of the first female pilots became a pilot much earlier than you maybe would expect based on, you know, the number of male to female pilots there are right now. But then it just, she faced tremendous sexism and it didn't work out for her to stay as a pilot. And then it was decades before airlines would hire another woman. And there's always so much pressure when you are breaking out of the mold of what society, you know, wants people to be, and we like to put them in boxes and particularly marginalized groups, and being both a woman and from an indigenous perspective, the dominant culture likes to keep both of these people groups from reaching their full potential. Did you feel sort of extra pressure that you were going to have to really put something great out there, or else it's going to be one of those things where it's like, oh, well, that's, you know, just another book by just another, you know, whatever.
Right. Honestly, yes, I have put pressure on myself. It's not any pressure that I've gotten from, you know, certainly my publisher or my agent. In fact, my agent will talk me down when I'm starting to spiral. But in the lead up to the book publication date, I was nervous because when you're from a marginalized community, it's kind of like, okay, when there's a movie that's directed by a person of color, it's like they get one shot to be excellent. And if they don't meet expectations or the studio doesn't make a profit, well, then it's going to be a very long time before that studio takes a chance on another person of color as a director or, you know, in that role. And I worried that publishing might be like that as well, just because there are so few stories about Native Americans by Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And so I felt a responsibility to own voices, that I didn't want to do any damage, that if my book didn't perform well, I worried what that might mean for other Native authors. And that is a shame to feel that, but that is my reality. At the risk of being controversial, mediocre white male directors always get multiple chances to be mediocre, but a person of color, a woman, we get less chances, and that is the current reality.
Are you able to have this kind of creative control as this book takes on its next life? It's being made into a Netflix series picked up by the production company Higher Ground, run by one Michelle and former President Barack Obama. First of all, congratulations. That's an incredible journey for a first-time novelist. But now, as it goes into this next phase, you talked about the importance of working with your editor and you being able to still say, no, I'm not comfortable with the book going this direction. Will you have that same kind of creative control as it moves on?
In a word, no. Oh. But because the film options, you have to think of it like fan fiction, that when you sign that contract for the film rights, you are handing over your baby, your book baby, to other people to shape and mold and to have their creative voice on your project. The time when an author has that negotiating power is when you're in conversations with the different production companies that are interested in optioning your book. And so I would ask questions about, or I would make it clear that a very strong priority of mine was to have Native creative talent, not just in front of the camera, but behind the camera, in the writer's room. Like, it was very important for me that own voices meant more than just my written words. It was throughout the production of this book to a series. And so, you know, there were production companies that, let's say, they weren't in sync with that, or they had a different vision, or it was clear they hadn't done their homework about it. And I knew I would be doing Indians 101 with them. And that was so not the case with Higher Ground Productions. They immediately, they got it. They had done their homework. They knew of people in the industry that they wanted to work with. It was really exciting. And that's what is so, I mean, yes, of course, the Obamas, yes. But that vision needed to be, they needed to get that. And they completely, Higher Ground Productions, I cannot speak any more highly than they are the best partners in the world.
Do you know when will we get to watch this?
I don't know much about the film and streaming worlds, but I do know that things take a lot longer than I would ever imagine. So really, I honestly don't know.
Well, luckily, we do know you have a lot of patience if it took a few decades to get this book out there.
Yes.
Will we have to wait a few more decades for your next book?
No, no, you will not. I recognize that I do not have the luxury of 10 years to, but I'm hoping that I've learned a lot about writing the first one, that the second one goes smoother. So yeah, my book deal with Macmillan was for two books. And so I do have a book two that I'm working on.
Can you give us any teasers?
Yes. If book one is Indigenous Nancy Drew, book two is Indigenous Lara Croft.
Oh.
Instead of raiding tombs, the main character is reclaiming ancestral remains and cultural items from museums to bring them back home. And one of her heists goes very badly.
All right. Well, I am going to pre-order that right now. Angeline, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And that was author Angeline Booley. Her first novel is Firekeeper's Daughter. She was selected as an emerging young adult writer in 2019 and was chosen to attend the 2019 Tin House YA Writers Workshop. She is a former director of Indian education at the U.S. Department of Education. And she is an enrolled member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. You can find out more about her at angelinebooley.com. The book is widely available. Coming up next, we celebrate independent bookstores.
The resilient spirit of Medoro soars on the next Great American Folk Show. I'm Tom Brusseau. We'll hear from cowboy poet Bill Lohman, who's part of the 35th annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering in the Western Tourist Town, and Mary Griffin, who shares a monologue on Medoro's All Horses Flag Day Parade. And what would a celebration of one of Teddy Roosevelt's favorite places to be without Joe Wiegand's Notes from the Badlands? Plus, enjoy live music from ragtime guitar player Mary Flowers.
The blues that I got on my mind, I mean the meanest kind, the blues my naughty sweetie gives to me.
You're gonna love celebrating Creole culture with Zydeco star Corey Ledette.
Might take a bus, might take a train, never have to walk, I'm going just the same.
More live music from father-daughter duo Music Across the Water and singer-songwriter Ben Suki.
Life is good. Life is great.
A little Sounds of Summer preview on the Great American Folk Show. Listen Sunday, May 2nd at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. This Saturday is Independent Bookstore Day, so we thought we'd share an essay from Wendy Welch, the author of The Little Bookstore of Big Stone Gap, a memoir of friendship, community, and the uncommon pleasure of a good book. Her book explores what it means to open an independent bookstore at a time when physical books seem to be disappearing. Allison Quantz reports.
This is Jack Beck, co-owner of the first bookstore in Big Stone Gap, Virginia.
See, there never had been a bookstore in Big Stone Gap before, ever.
And here's his partner and wife, Wendy Welch.
We had always talked about opening a bookstore someday. You know, someday when you retired, someday when I was teaching college. It was one of those things people always say, someday I'm gonna.
When they first moved to Big Stone Gap, they weren't actually planning on opening a bookstore. But then they found this old Victorian house for sale, and suddenly that someday just snuck up on them.
The first thing you do is you take your own personal book collection and you ruthlessly promise each other that you are going to put every book you will die without parting with into the bookstore.
The couple had 2,000 books to start the store. Not quite enough. So Wendy started haunting yard sales around the town.
And I collected this 1,500 or so volumes of Reader's Digest condensed books and Farrah Fawcett 1970 Detox Diets and Jackie Collins past bestsellers.
Next, they had to find a way to advertise.
We printed up very small bookmarks. Jack stuffed 3,000 of these in his pockets, and he went up to the Super Walmart. It was the only place that was selling books in the whole three-county area. He stood outside the doors of Walmart, and as people walked in, he just handed them a bookmark.
And somehow, improbably, their bookstore, called Tales of the Lonesome Pine, has been a huge success. Recently, they took a road trip to see how the economy was affecting other used bookstores. What they learned is a little different from what they had been hearing on the news.
A lot of the bookstores that we had gone into, we found were almost like community centres. It's where people would gather to chat, to have a coffee, to just hang out.
Even with Nooks and Kindles and Amazon, Wendy and Jack don't seem worried about the future of these brick-and-mortar bookstores.
You're coming to the bookstore to talk to the bookstore owner, to enjoy a meaningful conversation, which you cannot get when you surf the net.
In fact, when they talk about the role small bookstores play in communities, they sound so confident. It's almost like they know something about the rest of us that we haven't figured out yet.
Many people over the years coming into our store have said, oh, I always wanted to open a bookstore. It seems to be something that, you know, lots of people have hovering at the back of their mind. So, you know, potentially there are an awful lot of bookstore owners out there.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
There are a handful of independent bookstores in North Dakota. At Main Street Books in Minot, they're observing Saturday's Independent Bookstore Day by offering a free book with purchase. And they also have a bake sale to support the Minot Pollinator Project. And they'll be donating 10% of sales to that project. And if you spend $50 or more, you get a reusable bag while supplies last. In Fargo, Zanbros has 15% off and is offering a free surprise book with purchase. They have drawings for prizes, a children's story hour, and in-store author signings. Ferguson Books and More has stores in West Fargo, Grand Forks, and Bismarck. With each purchase on Saturday, they're giving away a tree you can plant for Arbor Day. And there's Books on Broadway in Williston and Western Edge Books in Medora, plus a handful of stores across the state that feature used books. So check out your local bookstore this Saturday for Independent Bookstore Day. Dakota Datebook is next.
This is Vera Woodley from Humanities Indy's Game Changer series.
This generation of people, right, we can't make the mistake to think that we can do it on our own. It really has to be about transmitting our values of active citizenship to the generations who come after us as well, so that they are the kinds of people who can act to create the kind of world that we have been striving for.
Vera Woodley talks about social unrest and democracy tonight at 8 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 20th. On this date in 1915, baseball fans were abuzz as spring training began in Grand Forks. William Billy Fox had freshly taken up the role as manager of the Flickertails of the Northern League. Two games in, news reports boasted that he had a very strong team, one that showed improvements over the prior year. Although he had not been involved with the team previously and was not from the area, a good number of locals had met Fox through baseball and knew him by reputation. He had played in the major leagues with the Washington Senators and the Cincinnati Reds. One man was quoted as saying, "Fox is a gentleman. Baseball is a business proposition with him, and he runs it as any other business, honorably, cleanly, and with a view of making it appeal to all. He is a wonderful leader and always has the respect of his men, which tells a whole lot. He was also described in newspapers as a thorough baseball manager. He knows the game from every angle and has the faculty of getting the best out of his players. He is an excellent strategist, and his baseball judgment and experience undoubtedly will be one of the greatest assets Grand Forks has. He even became the deciding factor in a grade school game. He ruled that an umpire had made a wrong decision during a game which led to the team's replaying the last three innings. Playing and managing baseball was not Billy Fox's only business, which ultimately led to his departure. In early July, he sold the rights to an anti-bulging dress shirt to the United Shirt and Collar Company in New York. In addition to shirt design, Fox also dabbled in baseball inventions, having come up with a number of improvements for baseball equipment, for which he was currently receiving a handsome royalty from the A.G. Spalding Company. With Billy departing for his home in Minneapolis, the Grand Forks team disbanded, with some players going back to their homes in other states, and others catching on with other teams. Billy Fox died in 1946 at the age of 74 in Minneapolis. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Voters in Philadelphia have chosen a progressive as their new district attorney.
You want to be safe, you don't need this many jails.
My guys don't trust you. What am I to tell them?
I suggest you don't shoot unarmed people in the back.
There's no mass incarceration.
This will be controversial.
The DA's office is not a place a social experiment should be conducted.
You're being lied to.
Philly DA, only on PBS.
Watch Philly DA, a new series from Independent Lens, tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Midnight Cowboy was a movie ahead of its time, and it is the subject of the new book, Shooting Midnight Cowboy. Our resident film fan, Matt Olean, talks with the book's author, Glenn Frankel. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.